This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, we share our thoughts on a variety of films, including Shazam, Dumbo, Pet Sematary, The Beach Bum, and Unicorn Store, among a few others from Ryan's perspective. But we're going to get things started. You know, we were debating as we came into this, how am I possibly going to start this? But I decided I'm going to start with the Harmony Korine film, the film that most people have not seen. And this is a film called The Beach Bum, starring the one and only Matthew McConaughey. And safe to say, he's going for it in this one, as you have to with Harmony Korine. And for those of you that don't know Harmony Korine, he's certainly the definition of an indie filmmaker. He's never really gotten into the mainstream. In fact, you know, it's arguable that The Beach Bum is the most mainstream he will ever possibly get, which I'm sure if anyone out there who is from a typical movie going on instead has seen it, I think you understand what I mean, even if you have no context of who this filmmaker is. But safe to say, The Beach Bum is a wild experience. It almost felt like one gargantuan montage, although it's more like a few different montages rolled together. But essentially, it focuses on this a wild Matthew McConaughey playing this character of Moondog, who's just going on an odyssey through Miami and its surrounding waters. And there's not really much more plot that I could say other than that, because that's the plot. I mean, he's going around, and there are just really these extended sequences where he interacts with a local or is paired up with another really fun actor who's doing something as equally wild, and it's just really, it really is a blast to watch. You know, people have, like I said, you know, people have actually, I think I read some of the producers were hyping up as, oh, The Beach Bum, this is Harmony Korine going to the mainstream, and after seeing it, I'm like, yeah, I mean, most audiences are still not going to be able to know what to make of this, you know, but I feel like if you go in with an open mind and just are like ready to just have craziness thrown at the screen, you could do a lot worse, safe to say. I definitely laughed a lot throughout the movie, and that certainly says a lot about me as a human being. But this is Korine's long-awaited follow-up to a film that both of us, I know, really loved, which is a film called Spring Breakers with James Franco and a great cast, including Selena Gomez. So it's just really wild. Well, Harmony Korine continues his collaborations with the High School Musical, as in that film he paired up with Vanessa Hudgens, and one of the standouts in this film is Zac Efron, who is a part of one of these random extended sequences. So like I said, there isn't really much story or plot to this, other than there is sort of a big death in the movie that I was not expecting, that sort of came out of nowhere, but the way it was dealt with in the movie was just pure Harmony Korine, and it was almost both emotional and hilarious at the same time. And I know that sounds really weird, but Harmony Korine is someone who's working on so many different emotions at the same time, and this film is sort of the perfect representation sort of that. But getting back to Zac Efron, so like I said, I'm just going to sort of go through some of these few sequences, not getting into too much spoilers, but I just want to call out a few elements that I just, like, I just couldn't believe, and they were so wild that I just couldn't help but enjoy them. But in the sequence, basically, McConaughey and Zac Efron, they're just going wild across the city, drinking it up, having a good time. But Zac Efron has this one line, and I'm sort of paraphrasing here, I don't have the exact quote, but I just felt like I'd share it here, and I think you understand what this movie is going for. But Zac Efron said, as they're just essentially performing chaos across the Miami street, he said, "Jesus already died for our sins, we're good." Essentially was the point of this. So essentially, you know, they don't have any, you know, Moondog, the central character played by McConaughey, he doesn't have any, I guess you could say, to say rules in his life, so he's just pure chaos. And Isla Fisher plays his sort of plays his wife, who is very rich, and she just lets him go off and do this. And Moondog, he writes poetry, so it's really odd, he's just going around drinking, acting like the craziest person you've ever seen. If a person like this came up to you in real life, you know, on your everyday life, you would probably run the other way, but the people of Miami just seem to roll with it, and it's just really crazy. But like I said, there's that sequence with Efron. There's a lot of interesting pairings. You know, there's obviously Snoop Dogg's in the film, essentially just playing himself. Jimmy Buffett is in a lot of the scenes with Snoop Dogg, which is a really interesting dynamic, along with Matthew McConaughey. And it is just, I mean, it's hard to even describe, but without question, and I'm certainly not the first to call this sequence out as a true standout of the film, but there's this amazing sequence with the returning Martin Lawrence to the big screen, and it is just, I'm not going to say anything more, but just that this sequence, even if you don't see the movie or can't get through it, you at least have to, after the movie's released and this sequence is up on YouTube, you at least have to check this out. The infamous Martin Lawrence sequence that takes place out in the ocean in this film. And it is just, I mean, it just definitely, you certainly need to have, like I said, an open mind with your sense of humor. But I think a lot of people would just be able to enjoy that sequence on just a pure comedy level. You know, and overall, there's just a lot of just wild stuff. It's hard to really say much more than, you know, there's wild sex sequences. There's this sequence between McConaughey and Isla Fisher that I couldn't even believe what I was seeing, but I loved it. And I just love that the film treats like all this insanity as just a part of these characters' lives, and it's really just going on this odyssey with them. And while I wasn't as big a fan as I was of his previous film, Spring Breakers, I think there's definitely a lot to love here, and I think it's just really consistently funny, and sometimes, you know, a movie, you know, you don't have to ask for anything more than that.
You know, I hope if my wife came into a lot of money, she would allow me that same leniency as Isla Fish's character seems to give McConaughey in this film. Before I transition to my first film, I just kind of want to give a backstory about this episode. Basically, my car is falling apart, so I was not able to afford to see any of the movies that were on the list this week. So I just kind of turned to Netflix and a couple other streaming services to get my fill. But I want to start with a movie. And I'm working backwards in the order that I actually saw them, because I think that I kind of came to a conclusion when watching these films. The first film I'm going to talk about is Brie Larson's long gestating directorial debut, Unicorn Store. And good Lord, is this movie insane. I mean, you can probably guess from the trailer that it's marketed towards a younger audience, and that's totally fine. Obviously, I'm not in that target market, even though she still has that millennial angst permeating throughout the whole thing, which, you know, in a week where I'm shit broke, really resonates. So that's fine. And, you know, Brie Larson's so good as an actor, she can sell ice to an Eskimo. So no problems on that front. But it basically centers around this, like, 28, 29-year-old woman who basically begins work at a temp agency after she flunks out of art school because, you know, she's just trying to be herself. And, you know, there's a scene to open the film where they have to do self-portraits, and she basically just makes this super colorful palette that her older art teacher, who is supposed to be, like, super serious and smug critic, just pans and flunks her out. And, you know, obviously Brie Larson's public persona, you know, she's talked about the need for more diversity and film criticism, so it is definitely a not so subtle jab there. And, you know, as the movie unfolds, and I could sit there and I could, like, kind of pick it apart on a technical level and say, oh, screenplay, blah, 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 editing, whatever. Actually, the movie's pretty efficiently edited, I will give it that. But I just think that the sheer conviction behind this story itself, and how, you know, she's down in the dumps and Samuel L. Jackson magically appears as this, I don't even know how to describe it. It might be his weirdest performance ever. He's basically the salesperson at this unicorn store. And she says that, and he says that Brie Larson needs to get prepared and prove that she's worthy to have a unicorn because she's the person that needs it most right now. And so she's going on this journey of building a stable in her backyard, and it just progresses from there. She's being sexually harassed at work by her boss, who's played by the guy in Legion who was part of the bad, I'm trying to remember, he was in like the bad guy team in the beginning where he's interviewing someone in the pool, something along those lines. He's really creepy, but otherwise Joan Cusack is in this. What a delight to actually see her in something again that's, you know, she's actually having a little bit of fun with. Bradley Whitford's in here. Bradley Whitford does as Bradley Whitford does. This is really the Brie Larson show. She's really just putting all of her body and soul into this, and it really shows, and it's really endearing. And obviously, as a millennial, I can certainly relate to a lot of the woes that she's going through, and even if this is geared towards maybe like a teenage audience per se. But there's just, I keep on coming back to this idea of, you know, the expressing yourself creatively that she makes over and over again throughout the course of this movie, and realizing that maybe seeing a movie through a different pair of eyes will give you a very different perspective. I mean, for instance, one of the movies that I'm going to be talking about in a little bit is actually rated 4.5 stars on Amazon. I would not be quite that generous with it, but I'll get to that in a minute. But I just think that, like, certain things hit you at different times, and I'm wearing down as I get older. This is not, you know, staunch film criticism that we're doing. We're just two film buffs who happen to appreciate and enjoy a lot of these filmmaking techniques that we've learned about through, you know, fairly enough through criticism, etc. But I just think that, you know, we're going to shit on Brie Larson, you know, for saying that criticism is ultimately hollow when we gave an Oscar, actually three Oscars, to Alejandro Gonzalez and Iñárritu for saying the same thing in Birdman. It just seems hypocritical to me. So is it as technically proficient from a more traditional standpoint? Well, obviously not, but it's her first film. She's learning, and it's totally well-directed. She did a very good job with this film. It's confident, and it's enjoyable. I mean, I've long said on this podcast, and I will continue to say until the day I die, that there is no magic in my heart whatsoever, but damn it, I was taken back by this movie.
Well, I'm definitely a big Brie Larson fan, so I'm intrigued to see, you know, that I definitely will probably get around to it, and I'll definitely check it out. But speaking of magic, I guess I'll just transition into another film, you know, that I saw the last couple weeks was Tim Burton's live-action reimagining of the Disney classic Dumbo. And safe to say, I feel like this film is thoroughly mediocre, but it definitely has some positives that a lot of recent Tim Burton fare does not share. But essentially, just to give you sort of the bare bones of the story here, because I don't have Ryan here to count on to give these efficient plot summaries. But essentially, the film starts with, you know, Colin Farrell returning from the war, returning to the circus where he's worked, and returning to the children he left behind. And there's a bit of a backstory with, you know, his wife has sort of passed away, and so now he's left to care for his kids. But essentially, he returns, and Danny DeVito, the head of the circus, he assigns Colin Farrell. He used to be, you know, riding horses for the circus, but now with his condition, he's sort of forcing him to train the elephants. And of course, you could see where this is going if you know the classic Dumbo story. And obviously, for those of you that know that classic animated film, know how dark and depressing that film is. I can definitely say that Tim Burton's film is not that dark or depressing, although it certainly has elements of it. So the fact that you can even say that about a Tim Burton film is, you know, might seem like a victory in and of itself. But it is one of the rare, as I was alluding to, one of the rare recent Tim Burton films where it actually benefits from the production design and costume design. There's this great set piece later on where essentially, you know, Michael Keaton is playing this sort of tycoon figure who swoops in, you know, the circus is sort of failing, you know, Danny DeVito doesn't have exactly the money, so Michael Keaton sort of swoops in and sort of helps him out. And of course, Michael Keaton's intentions aren't exactly the most pure, and he creates this, instead of this typical circus, now it's this dreamland with this really sort of really evocative classic Tim Burton production design. And I think it's actually really good and some of the best production design I've seen from Tim Burton in a while. But what's really interesting about this element is that Disney made this film, and that the essential story of the film, if you really look at it, it's essentially a story about how, you know, a big corporation corrupts this small circus. And essentially, the villain, the biggest plot point, as I just mentioned, is Michael Keaton essentially turning, you know, a mom and pop circus, he's essentially Disney-fying it. And then treating animals horribly. So I think something, I don't know how this got through Disney. I guess they're just not that self-aware, that they weren't aware enough to realize that Tim Burton, it felt like Tim Burton is actually directly criticizing Disney in some way. So I thought that was really interesting, and I wasn't really expecting that at all. But like I said, I thought the film was pretty mediocre, especially early on. I was very worried because I thought there was a lot of attempts at humor. For those of you that know the classic Dumbo story, there's of course some Dumbo bullying going on from the circus audience, and I almost felt like it was almost so over the top that it was verged on ridiculous, where it was like impossible to buy into. I got the point, they're meant to be obnoxious towards him, but it was almost like too much that I was like very weird. And there was just also some weird comedic attempts at humor with the circus and the other inhabitants of it that I just thought was, it just felt a bit out of place. But eventually, you know, like I said, you know, eventually I really did start enjoying the film, particularly when that big Dreamland production design really comes into the fray, and we sort of build to the climax of the story. But I think the issue with the film overall is that there isn't really much to be attached to in terms of the characters. In fact, the only character I felt attached to in any way was the CGI Dumbo, you know, like, because they did such a great job just making you care for him just through a visual sense. But even the kids who are attached to Dumbo, they don't really get a lot to chew onto. I alluded to the backstory with the mother who had passed away. They don't really do enough with it to get to that point where it really feels like the audience is invested in the characters. And in fact, this is a film that if someone else handled the script, I could easily see this being like one of the worst films of the year, because the script definitely is not the strong point of this. And honestly, I think it's some of Tim Burton's best directing in recent years, although I guess when you compare it to the other stuff he's directed, that's not exactly, you know, exactly say showering him with praise. But I do think, you know, it's a good-hearted attempt at Dumbo, and I could see that Tim Burton's heart was definitely in the right place. There's even this kind of creepy sequence later on that's tied into Dreamland that I thought was really evocative. But other than that, you know, it's really hard to say. Like I said, I feel very middle of the road about this film. I didn't hate it. I don't think it's bad, but I think it's just really mediocre, and I think in the hands of another director, it definitely could have been much worse, and I think that's the highest praise I can give Tim Burton in modern times.
You know, believe it or not, I've never actually seen the original, so I don't necessarily feel like I would have had a strong opinion on this one way or another, but Mary Poppins is still fresh in my mind, so I'm glad I get to kind of pass this one over with a clean conscience. The next film that I chose to review for this podcast for some ungodly reason is something that came out back in October. It just kind of got lost in the shuffle. There were more interesting things to us, but we did hear that this was just pure car crash entertainment and schlock, and good lord did it deliver in spades. That would be Dan Fogelman's Life Itself. For those of you who don't know, Dan Fogelman is best known at this point for creating This Is Us, the NBC drama that just inexplicably has the highest ratings on that the network has seen in a very long time. But he also directed Crazy Stupid Love from like almost 10 years ago now.
He wrote it.
He wrote Crazy Stupid Love, but that was a solid film. So, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. A broken clock is right twice a day. Jesus, I don't even know where to start with this movie. So I remember I texted you while I was watching it, and I think I said something. I was drunk, so please forgive me. It's something to the effect of this movie breathes the same air as the Book of Henry. And I know, I don't want to twist myself into a pretzel trying to overthink exactly what I saw, because I know that I just said, you know, what is art, what is critique, can't we just, you know, go based on pure feeling if something works or doesn't work for us, even if that does include admiring certain filmmaking techniques. I still have to call bullshit when I see it. I don't know what the hell Fogelman was thinking with this. Basically, it starts off with... for some reason, it starts off with Samuel L. Jackson doing a voiceover about Annette Bening walking down the street. Annette Bening, for some reason, the costume designer was channeling Elizabeth Warren with these style choices and the haircut. But she's walking along talking to Oscar Isaac. And she gets hit by a bus, and Sam Jackson just like freaks out. And then you find out that Oscar Isaac is actually writing a screenplay in a coffee shop, and this is the opening scene to his screenplay. And then there's like some ham-fisted thing, like he was dating Olivia Wilde, and in college Olivia Wilde just happened to be fucking working on her thesis about the unreliable narrator, go figure, and they just beat you over the head mercilessly with this. But so basically the plot centers around Oscar Isaac, and I don't want to spoil too much because I do think that there is just pure car crash entertainment in this first half. The second half goes completely off the rails and is just dull as dirt, and it gets really offensive from an insulting my intelligence standpoint. But basically, Oscar Isaac and Olivia Wilde start this romance, and then something tragic happens that you don't really find out till halfway through. And basically, the whole thing is Oscar Isaac going back in time, like into his psyche with Annette Bening as a psychiatrist, and they're like going through his memories. But it's done in a way where obviously they're still in the office, but he's doing such a vivid job in describing what happened throughout the course of their lives, and you know, up into the birth of their daughter, and all that. Oh my God, this movie's infuriatingly beautiful. I can't stand it, but I love it at the same time. If I could get at least, you know, 10 movies a year like this, we'd all be better off, because there's just so much joy when a movie goes off the rails so hilariously. And I can't even say, like, I don't even want to say the words good or bad anymore. This movie was just an experience. The performances are just so over the top middle brow stuff that you'd expect from someone who's just like swinging for Oscar gold in 1994. All movies are manipulative to an extent. A movie wants you to feel a certain way. So I think calling a movie manipulative is just kind of a cheap shot to take at a film. But here, you're not sure, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you're not sure how you're supposed to feel about this, and you're taking on such a bevy of emotions, and you're just put through the ringer with such terrible dialogue and such odd stylistic choices, and then it culminates, oh, good Lord, I can't even fathom, the unreliable narrator thing comes up a couple times throughout the course of the film, and I'm just thinking back to what the actual final reveal of the film is, and it's just so far out of left field, it makes no sense, and it's just such a vain attempt to try to make some kind of sense out of everything that they just threw at us. This movie is just, you know, pure delightful trash. I'm going to hold this 10 years from now, I'm going to be talking about this movie and Batman and Robin in the same breath. This was just pure joy from start to finish, but it was not technically good, I guess.
Well, I'd say I'm going to check it out, but I know I won't. So, but I am intrigued based on the wild stuff. I mean, I had heard many things about it, but some of what you were describing, I had no idea what you were talking about. So I think that speaks to the movie itself.
Yeah, Sam Jackson does not show up for the rest of the film after that.
I guess he was busy with that unicorn store, but or playing Nick Fury a million times. Yeah. But I guess we can I guess I can transition into the next film, which I guess I'll talk about Shazam, which obviously, you know, is the big film sort of out in theaters right now as we're really kickstarting the summer movie season with these weeks, obviously building to Avengers Endgame. But Shazam is the latest from DC, and it's definitely one of their best in recent memory, to say the least. Shazam is just really fun. It's just really entertaining, light fun, and it isn't much more than that, and it doesn't really need to be. Essentially, it centers on the character of Billy Batson, who in his regular form as a kid is played by Asher Angel. And essentially he's sort of without a family. He's been moving from group home to group home. And he's essentially near the beginning of the movie, he's placed in this new group home, and he figures it's going to be much of the same. But he meets his new sort of foster brother, Freddy, played by Jack Dylan Grazer, who is absolute dynamite in this film. And essentially, you know, what happens after this is Billy's magically gifted with superhero powers. And then with Freddy, his new foster brother, being a superhero expert, he's sort of his coach and coaching him through his superhero exploits. And like I said, sometimes a movie doesn't have to be anything more than pure fun. And that's exactly what this is. This is like a perfect family film, but I think it works for all ages because it's funny, it's enjoyable, it has really unique characters, and I think that's something that we haven't seen enough, especially from DC, safe to say, in their recent films. But you know, I'm sure many of you have seen the trailers, and the trailers really give this away, but Zachary Levi is absolute perfection and perfectly cast in this role. He's essentially already a man-child. For those of you that don't know, essentially what happens is Billy Batson is, you know, given these powers, and then every time he says Shazam, he turns in to the essentially adult version, but Zachary Levi is obviously playing him as a kid, and I think it's such a joy to watch Zachary Levi play this character and bounce back and forth with Jack Dylan Grazer playing Freddy, and it's just a really fun experience. I loved the foster home dynamic, and trust me, it's not just limited to these two foster brothers. There's other characters as well. One in particular, I'm blanking on her name, but she's this young sister in the foster home, and I thought she was so good, so funny. And I think the film, safe to say, I'm not gonna spoil this, but safe to say, the film goes in some interesting directions towards the climax that I was not expecting, and the climactic sequence is an absolute blast to watch, and very unexpected. But you know, the film, although like I said, it was really just pure light fun, it does have enough of emotional heart to really attach to with the character of Billy Batson. There's this running through line where he's trying to find his biological mother. There's even a scene early on where we learn sort of how he has sort of been estranged from her, and I thought was really heartbreaking the way the movie handles it, but I thought it was even more effective because of it, and made this sort of foster family dynamic really work. Mark Strong plays the villain, and honestly, you know, he's sort of one of these actors who has been, much like these Christoph Waltz or Ben Mendelsohn types, who have been cast as villains over and over again. I think this film uses him, you know, it's definitely some of the best I've seen, you know, in this type of role. And even his character gets a really fascinating backstory, which is actually sort of serves as sort of the cold open to the film, which I was not expecting, and it was really wild. And also, just as a side note, you know, this movie is actually set during Christmas, which is a really interesting dynamic. I don't know if they originally planned for it to be released during Christmas, and although Christmas isn't a large part of it, there are some elements. There's this running gag, I mean, I'm not gonna spoil this, but there's this running gag involving Santa Claus that I nearly spit out whenever I was chewing on popcorn near the end, when it sort of paid off. But there's some really weird comedic things going on that I was not expecting. And I think, like I said, I think it's just really fun and a joy to watch at times. And, you know, DC should definitely take note of this. You know, obviously, a lot of DC characters don't lend themselves to this type of story, this pure fun dynamic. But it's just so refreshing and such a blast. Whereas, you know, with Aquaman, on the sense, you know, on the overall, you know, when you look at it, it's very colorful and brash and bold, but the writing and the performances don't really reflect that. Whereas here in Shazam, you know, there's bright colors, but the performances and everything is working towards that tone. And I think it's just, like I said, it's just really, really fun. And for those of you that don't know, you know, The Rock has, you know, essentially, you know, years ago, he was essentially given the choice to choose between whether he wanted to play Shazam or his, you know, arch nemesis, you know, Black Adam. And essentially, you know, Rock came out after the success of this opening screen. It's like, oh, it's happening. So I'm really intrigued to see how this dynamic plays out, because it's really, I don't know, like, all I'll say is, if you've seen Shazam, I think you could see why it's really hard to picture Dwayne The Rock Johnson in this universe or in this world. So I'm really intrigued to see what direction they go with it and how he's sort of playing his character. But I also think it could be really unexpected and a lot of fun, and there's some really wild mid-credit sequence in particular that I don't pretend to be very well versed in Shazam, but to say I looked up some stuff after the fact, and it's really intriguing to see what direction they go. But honestly, I just thought it was just really fun, and if I can say that about a recent DC blockbuster, they've already won.
That's completely fair enough. You know, it's The Rock really has a very unique energy, and he's, you know, heretofore unseen, really. I mean, from any pro wrestler turned actor or actor in general. But maybe that is the kind of shot of adrenaline that DC really needs to keep him propelling in the right direction, because we really don't, you know, people want to shit on Marvel for getting too jokey in their movies, but we've seen what happens when someone tries to go the Christopher Nolan route one too many times, and good lord, we've had some, and you know, I didn't like Aquaman either, so there. But moving on to the final film I'd like to kind of discuss this week. And I say kinda because I'm going to kind of contradict myself from a review I gave in a film back in November. Again, I use the word review loosely. But I want to take a look at Jeff Tremaine's Motley Crue biopic that's based on Nikki Sixx's autobiography, Dirt, or The Dirt, whatever. But it's on Netflix, it's streaming right now, and good God, this, you want to talk about insane. I know we've had some weird ones in this podcast today, but this one is unfortunately the most grounded in reality, and I think that's the scariest part of it, because there is I can't believe that human beings actually put their bodies through all this stuff and still somehow came on the other end better off for it, and unscathed for it. Well, I don't want to say unscathed, I mean, good lord, Vince Neil died on a... Oh, no, Nikki Sixx was the one that actually died on a table and then had to be revived. But it basically follows... It's your standard musical biopic. It's directed by Jeff Tremaine of Jackass and Bad Grandpa fame. And this is his first film he's directed that's not within that universe. So I didn't even know that he directed it in the first place, until we got to the end credits, and then having seen it now, that definitely makes sense. They certainly, especially in the early, you know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll up until the midpoint scene when things start turning sour with Vince Neil's car crash, it's you know, pure... just insanity. I can't describe it any better than that. There's the famous gross out contest with Ozzy Osbourne is depicted here in all of its hilarious glory. You know, there's just rampant, you know, open wanton sexuality. Like, there's one amazing oral sex joke early in the film that involves Machine Gun Kelly, who plays Tommy Lee in the film. And it's just like it's a joke that you'd expect from Jeff Tremaine, and I'll leave it at that. And there is a lot of that running through. This is the 80s. This was all that, you know, the macho metal misogyny, and you know, the film doesn't necessarily, and if anything, I think it gives the band a pass on some things that maybe they shouldn't have, while still rightfully shining a light on the more nefarious aspects of their celebrity. But it takes us right from the beginning all the way up until their farewell tours back, I think it was only a few years ago at this point. So, you know, while I was crucifying a film like Bohemian Rhapsody for just, like, with nothing absolutely having any impact whatsoever, it's just montage into writing a song, this film kind of takes a similar structure, although not necessarily based around writing the songs per se. But it's just, you know, it doesn't leave any time on the table to let things actually land. And that actually plays into the film's benefit. Like, late in the film, after Vince Neil realizes that, he has a half brother, which just kind of gets dumped on you in the middle of the nowhere when he goes and visits, or excuse me, Nikki Sixx. He has a half brother that you find out about, who leads him to his father's grave, and like, this, oh yeah, dude, I can't believe my, you know, mama, I'm coming home. That was Ozzy, sorry. What's the Home Sweet Home, the Motley Crue? Yeah, you can tell I'm a huge fan. But it's just like these things are dumped on you, like Vince Neil's daughter's death. She died of some type of childhood cancer when she was like 5 or 6 years old. And there are scenes, just because the movie is so insane, but you're attached to these characters through all of this, like there's no pretension to any of it. So when things go really south and the film becomes deadly serious and super dark in the second half, you go with it and you feel it. It doesn't matter if none of this is given any depth whatsoever. This is just, it's a story that's told with a lot more sincerity than I think a movie like Bohemian Rhapsody was. I know maybe that was just because changing hands between directors, there wasn't a clear-cut vision on that. Might not be the best example, but there's just something about that propulsive energy, about their antics, and about, you know, how much fun they actually had doing this. And there is some great sequences when they're following Tommy Lee, Machine Gun Kelly as Tommy Lee, within a single take, taking him throughout the course of the day, and he's just showing, like, you know, waking up at 5 p.m., the drugs he has to take to get up, getting drunk after a show, just like continuing and going on and on and on until like 9 o'clock in the morning, and then sleeping from 9 to 5, and then going up and repeating the same routine. Like it's those subtle little things that they do to kind of break down break down the fun, I guess, and just show that like this actually was taking a horrendous, horrendous toll on these people. And you know, they all came from very bad places, and the film does not give them free passes on most stuff. So maybe it's even a hollow criticism on my part to say maybe they should have given them a free pass on this, that, or the other, because they really shine a very harsh light on these guys, and they should be commended for allowing their story to be told. I think there's some value in this, especially when you're dealing with substance abuse and deep-seated issues and mental health at large. That can only be a good thing. And I think, I mean, if that touches even one person who's struggling with substance abuse to just, you know, re-examine things or just relate to it in some way and make them feel like they're not alone, that's a success. At the end of the day, this film is deeply flawed in the same way that so many musical biopics are, and you don't know how the hell to feel. And it's actually like a half hour shorter than most of them too, which is so nothing, just like so many things are thrown at you, but it's just so enjoying from scene to scene that I like, who the hell cares? And Pete Davidson's in it too for some reason. I mean, go figure.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually seen some random think piece articles out there about how the music biopic is clearly broken at this point, which I think is, you know, definitely, it seems like a right take, but I guess we'll see with Rocketman and whatever else is going to be coming out in the next couple of years. But finally, we're at the last film that we're going to be taking a look at today, which is the remake of Pet Sematary. Easily, definitely the most recent of these films I'm reviewing today I've seen. And I feel like this is a tough one to talk about, because it's like, it's almost like, you know, much like the original is very flawed and not all there, the same is the case with the remake, although I will admit to be a bit grating on a scale, I guess you could say, with this remake, because it did improve on a couple of distinct aspects that I guess maybe made me enjoy the film more than perhaps I should have. But, you know, for those of you that don't know, you know, obviously this is based on, you know, classic Stephen King novel, and, you know, I hadn't seen the original until actually, you know, every October I always get like a list of movies and I just watch a bunch that I haven't seen, and I believe it was just this past Halloween where I've watched the original Pet Sematary for the first time. And safe to say, well, for those of you that haven't seen the original or are familiar with it, you may know that the lead performance in that film is infamously so bad, played by actor Dale Midkiff, and you're probably like, who? Well, you know why. Because he gave a literally one of the most one-note, like, unengaging performances I've ever seen. It's safe to say the remake improves on that tenfold with Jason Clarke, who actually shows emotion, who actually has different expressions on his face at the time, and honestly, I think if he wasn't in the film, I don't think I would have enjoyed it as more. And, you know, I think the key to the Pet Sematary story is that there really is an interesting concept at the heart of it, that, you know, that grief can obviously drive you to do unimaginable things and do things that you didn't even know were possible, you know, in the world. And I think there's such a great core idea, and I think Jason Clarke definitely brings a lot more of that here, but there's still not quite enough of it, where it's like, where it's there in a couple scenes and then it just sort of goes away and sort of fades into the background. I could definitely see a lot, you know, I feel like, you know, the reactions to this remake are sort of all over the map. I've seen people that completely hate it. I've seen a lot of people who are like, oh, it's definitely better than the original. You know, I feel like it's very sort of middle of the road. I definitely prefer it to the original, although I think what the original has going for it is pure camp value. The original has the benefit of Fred Gwen. I'm really hamming it up. Don't go down that road. You know how he says it. I mean, John Lithgow playing that role is good, but he's someone who I feel like is really wasted. Like, he gets a couple really good scenes, but he isn't in it enough to really have that impact that Fred Gwynne did in the original. I think, obviously, the original as well benefits from some really crazy visuals towards the end, to say the least, or whatever. And this one isn't as, I guess, it doesn't have as much camp. I guess some people would, you know, it's sort of very, I don't know, it's hard to say, but I guess I would say, like, it's hard to say, oh, it's darker than the original. Both of these are telling, you know, a very dark sort of horrific story, but it feels like this film just has a bit of a darker edge to it, and I just don't think it ever completely gels. Like I said, I think Jason Clarke is really good, and I also think the actress playing Ellie, Jette Lawrence, this young actress, I thought she was quite good, and they really give her, and, you know, this isn't a spoiler, because if you've seen the trailer, you know that the film gives away, you know, the big twist, whereas, you know, in the original, it's, you know, the young boy who is buried in the pet cemetery and comes to life. In this case, it's the young girl, and that's given away in the trailer, and I feel like the film might have been really much more impactful if that wasn't given away in the trailer. And, you know, I saw the filmmakers trying to explain it away, but after seeing the film, I do not understand it. I felt like the overall majority of the film was given away, although it definitely goes some crazy places at the end that I was not expecting. But I don't think the impact of those things at the end are really have the intended effect. And the film really, it sort of, it feels like a very abrupt end, although I kind of saw that, oh, this is ending here, but then it just sort of even more abruptly ends, and you're sort of like, what? You're just sort of left to sort of think about it, and then there's the classic reimagining of the classic Pet Sematary song over the end credits, which I couldn't get out of my head. For hours. But essentially, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think this new Pet Sematary remake is very good. I think it's mediocre, but I would say it definitely improves on some of the key elements to the original. But I think, you know, this story has not had its true adaptation yet. I was actually a bit disappointed with this film because it's directed by this pair of filmmakers, of indie filmmakers who were previously known for this really creative horror film called Starry Eyes, which was another film that I wasn't as crazy about as some other people were, but I thought it had enough interesting things in it that I ended up enjoying the experience. And I kind of feel similarly here, where Pet Sematary, it has some interesting things, and I feel like a lot of mainstream audiences are just going to feel like, oh my god, not much is happening at times. It can be very methodical and slow at times, and then when it gets to the climax, it feels like it's over, and it's like, what? So that was, I guess, you know, sort of an issue. There's a bit of pacing issues, but I thought there's some really creepy visuals, definitely involving the young girl, and I really loved the makeup that they used for her look. I thought it was really off-putting, and I thought there's some really, really interesting moments between, you know, Jason Clarke and his daughter in the new form or whatever. And I will say, give them credit, although they gave away the twist, you know, in the trailer, I do think it was the right decision. I think it makes the film, or have this dynamic between the father and daughter, much more interesting than you would with a baby who can't really speak. And I think that's some of the camp value from the original towards the end there, where you can enjoy it on a campy level, but it doesn't have any, you know, sort of realism to it. Not that you need it in the horror films, but I guess I would say, you know, like I said, this remake is a bit darker, has a bit more of an edge to it. But like I said, I feel much about it like I do the original. It's a mixed bag and it's not completely there, but I would say, I guess I enjoy the remake overall more than the original, but neither are really great.
I haven't seen the original since I was a kid, but I think I know what I'm watching this Halloween. You know, I do love my camp too, so I think I might just take a hard pass on the new one, plus animal stuff, I don't know. You know me, I'm a weirdo. But let's turn our attention to next week, where we will be getting back to regularly scheduled programming. I will get those words out somehow. Not even very well, but I got there. But we're going to be taking a look at another reboot in Hellboy, which has not had any reviews as of yet, but apparently it's going to... Okay.
Well, let me jump in right there, because apparently Ryan has not been following this, because there are a lot of reviews out there, and from the reports, this film is a complete and utter disaster. Yes. I think right now, I think it's at Rotten Tomatoes, I think it's at 9% with 43 reviews, and honestly, I'm much more excited to see this movie now, and I'm gonna probably go see it tomorrow because I can't wait to see the train wreck. People have said it's just a mess. You can't even tell what's going on. It just goes from action set piece to action set piece, and apparently it was down to, from some of the reports that are coming out here, producers were meddling and not letting Neil Marshall do his thing. So apparently it's just in a complete mixed bag. The actors are rewriting lines on script and stuff, and if that doesn't get you excited for our review, maybe it won't, but I'm excited, so I think that's all that matters, right?
Oh, thank the Lord, Joel Schumacher. Ask and you shall receive. I cannot wait for this one now. I checked the Rotten Tomatoes score yet, and I know Rotten Tomatoes is a very flawed vessel, but I checked it yesterday, and usually when there are no reviews by Wednesday afternoon, you know that they're holding it away from critics, so I could only assume the best, at least for me. But that's wonderful. I can't wait to see this now. But we're also going to be taking a look at the new one from Laika, which is just a studio that has a, let's say, more hits than misses, and those hits are absolute knockouts. But Missing Link, which, I don't know, kind of looks like fun. Hugh Jackman, Zach Galifianakis, that could be good.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited. I'm a big fan of Laika in general. I've loved pretty much most of their animated films I've seen, from Coraline to Paranorman to especially Kubo and the Two Strings, of course. So I'm really excited to see this. This looks like a more comedic, lighthearted one, but I really do love their animation style, so I'm definitely pumped for it, and we'll have our thoughts in the next episode.